Good morning, and thanks for coming to Stress in Jewish Law, or as I've come to think of it, Stress in Jewish Law, an Autobiography. Every day is different. Once again, thank you to the Bayit, Bayit Adult Education, for co-sponsoring, for making the room available, and promoting the shiur this morning. I want to thank Dr. Kirshen for his help in making sure that there is CME credit. Please make sure that you sign in, particularly if you want to get CME credit. That is important. There will be an online evaluation, which I will send out, God willing, as a follow-up later today or tomorrow. It is important for us that people fill those out, even if you are not actually doing this for CME credit. The university wants to get people's responses. It's short. I think it's 6 questions and fairly straightforward. So please look for that in your email. Also, this is actually the last of the sessions for this academic year at the Bayit. So far this year, we did here at the Bayit, we did Judaism and OCD back in October, the laws of giving up in end-of-life situations in December, and then in February we had How Does a Doctor Choose a Rabbi, and now we have Stress in Jewish Law. The Shari Shemayim ones were minors in medicine, who decides, cosmetic surgery / permanent makeup, dental emergencies on Shabbos, and then there's one more coming in May at Shari Shemayim, and that's medical care for terrorists, which, you know, is in the news all over again. But I'm recapping them in order to ask you to think about topics for next year. Because at this point I'm starting to look at that. I will hopefully include that request in an email as well, but start thinking of topics that we should be thinking about for next year. If you have the source sheets, you'll see that there's quite a bit there. And I put in headings to try to show where I'm going with this. I didn't use the usual vignette approach because of the different facets that I want to see within stress, and I felt it would be better with an outline structure. So what I want to do is begin by defining the sources as well as types of impact of stress as recognized medically and as recognized within traditional halachic literature. Once we've recognized what the sources of stress are and what the impacts of stress are, to move from that into the question of how Jewish law deals with the negative potential impacts of stress in its calculations, whether that's in terms of exemption from mitzvah, whether it's in terms of treatment on Shabbos, you know, some of the issues that are involved, and then go from there into the question of whether halacha views stress as something that can be defeated, or whether it's what we call in halacha ones, something uncontrollable, which has various practical ramifications. And then finally, to talk about a few coping mechanisms which come to us within Torah. This is designed as an overview, rather than deal with any one of these in hour-long depth. Each one is going to be sort of a slice of the issue. But I think we'll get an overall strong sense of how stress is viewed within Torah, within halacha. So we begin by defining stress. How would you define stress itself? Not examples, but definitions. Yes? No? That wasn't a bit? Yes, Sheldon.
Any action or this force that that may cause a change in the state of the system.
An event, an action that may cause a change in a system. So what Sheldon is describing, yeah.
This was some internal stress.
Okay. So it can come from, the event can occur from within the system, is what you're saying. Okay. What you're both describing is, you know, what more or less I would have expected as the definition of stress, which is there is a stressor. There is something which taxes the body in some way. And when we say the body, I don't just mean the body in terms of one's physical form, as we'll see. But it's something that creates an unusual taxation on the body's systems. It is picked up by the nerves, it is processed in the brain, and that yields a response. The truth of the matter is that as I've been reading the literature, I find that they actually view stress differently, even though that has to be the dictionary definition. They emphasize much more the body's response to the stressor rather than the stressor itself. Meaning that the same event occurring to two different people, the same stressor occurring to two different people, will lead to very different responses. In one person, it may lead to a fight or flight type of scenario, and the body is going to get going, trying to shift its resources and trigger reactions, which we're going to talk about. And in another person, everything is normal. It doesn't make a difference. For example, I'm getting up here and speaking publicly. I don't like public speaking, which I know is ironic, but it's true. And for me, getting up to speak will generate a certain degree of nervousness, which for somebody else, it may not at all. It's the same stressor, but it's gonna have different results, and they place a lot of emphasis on the response to it, as opposed to the stressor itself. If you take a look at your sheet, at the first source, this is from a very useful, Lazarus primarily, but in general, this piece, Stress and Coping in Anthology, I found this article useful. Three basic types of stress are typically delineated. Systemic or physiological, that's one. Psychological, two. And social. Systemic stress is concerned primarily with the disturbances of tissue systems, right, within the body. Psychological stress with cognitive factors leading to the evaluation of threat. And social stress with the disruption of a social unit or system. Because it's not only about the individual. The stress arena refers to any event in which environmental demands, internal demands, or both tax or exceed the adaptive resources of an individual, social system, or tissue system. So I like that last line as a definition. It fits with what was just said here, that environmental demands, internal demands, or both will tax or exceed the adaptive resources of an individual, a social system, or a tissue system. So the word stress itself doesn't originate within biology or psychology. Where does the word stress start? Physics, right. It's only in the 1920s, 1930s that they start to use it to describe events that occur in terms of medical stress, as opposed to a physics term. In halacha, you will find in contemporary writing usage of terms like lachatz or metach, which are terms that refer to pressure and stress, but or they'll talk about pachad as fear. But the classic term, going back to the days of the Talmud, was, anybody know? Good. Tiruf, or tiruf hadas, right? Literally a torn up mind. Describing the effect, interestingly, rather than describing the stressor. It's describing the person's response to the situation. One thing that was an eye-opener for me, although, once I read it made sense, was that sources of stress can be negative or positive events. Meaning stress doesn't have to be something terrible happened to me and that upset me. It can be from that, but doesn't have to be. There are physiological stressors which include, on the one hand, injury and illness, but on the other hand, pregnancy or change in diet. Even intentional change in diet is nonetheless a stressor on a system. They can be emotional stressors, fear, grief, deadlines, among the negatives. Marriage also, though, is an emotional stressor. Childbirth is also an emotional stressor. Moving, taking on a new job, all of these are causes of stress, physically and emotionally. And the Gemara recognizes that these positive and negative factors can be causes of stress, and it deals with them in halakhic calculations. So talking about some examples, and I endeavored to go with just primary sources straight out of the Gemara rather than later ones, just to show you how old the recognition of this is. If you take a look at source number 2, here's an example from a halachic calculation in which they look at emotional pain as a source of stress that can be dangerous for a person. If a patient's relative dies, somebody is ill, and they suffer the loss of a relative, we do not inform him of the death, lest his mind be torn. Right? There's the expression in the Hebrew, Shema titarev da to'alav, lest the person's mind be torn, so that you see a recognition, just a basic emotional pain and where it can lead. It's not only over that type of a grief situation. We find it also in cases of financial worry and religious worry. If you take a look at source number 3, this is an interesting discussion, which will bring us to both. It's talking about a young man who gets married. In the days of the Mishnah, you will recall that people got married traditionally on when? Anybody know the beginning of Ksubos?
Friday.
They get married on Wednesday night. Right, the idea of getting married on a Friday was something that was started later as a means of saving money. You know, your wedding meal was also a Shabbos meal. But no, in the days of the Mishnah, for reasons beyond the scope of our discussion right now, they would get married specifically on a Wednesday night. And that's important in terms of where we're going with this. The Mishnah says, Chasan pater mikriya shma. I'm actually going to read just the English. I brought the Hebrew for the sake of those who can read it, but in the interest of time, I'm going to stick with the English. A groom is exempt from shma from the first night, from the wedding night, until Saturday night, 4 nights, if he hasn't yet done the deed, as they say, perform the act. So which the Gemara asks, isn't this, because he is distracted by intent for the mitzvah of relations, in contact in the Gemara. The reason why the Gemara asks this question is because they're discussing a completely different issue of the Friday night. So as part of this discussion, they mention that isn't he exempt from Shema because he's distracted by wanting to perform this mitzvah of being with his wife for the first time? To which Abaye said no. Abaye says that's not the distraction. Rather, the distraction is that he is upset because it hasn't happened yet. That's the distraction. It's not distraction in pursuit of a mitzvah. It's just general distraction that this person is dealing with. To which Rava then replies and says, "It's not. You can't tell me that just any distraction would qualify to exempt him from reciting Shema. It has to be distraction because he is in pursuit of a mitzvah. Because Rava says, would one be exempt because of any distraction? So if somebody's boat sank at sea, in other words, he has a boat out there with merchandise and there are people working on the boat, is that going to be sufficient? If the boat sinks, now he's going to be exempt from reciting Shema?" And Rava says, absolutely not. Now, leaving aside Rava's calculation with this, because that's something I want to come back to, the reason I bring this right now is just to show the recognition of financial stress, as well as the recognition of religious stress, religious tension. He has a mitzvah to perform, and that is agitating him to the point where he won't be able to concentrate properly on Shema. You follow? There's more coming in that regard, but I'm going to go through a few other types of stress. Physical threats are a concern as well. The handouts are right there along with the source sheet, sorry. The physical threats are also considered sources of psychological stress which can impact on the body's systems. If you take a look at source number 4, they're dealing with the issue of a nida, a menstruant. And the Gemara here says, if a woman was in hiding, and they're talking about in Roman times and fear of the government, so if she was in hiding, when the time of the month came for her, she is presumed not to have bled if she didn't check. We can assume that she did not bleed. Why? Because fear removes bleeding. Harada misalekes es adamim is the expression in the Gemara. Fear is going to change her cycle. Now, I'll leave it to the doctors to discuss, you know, how exactly this works. I see already head shakes yes that fear does it. Without getting into details on that, the Gemara is recognizing that fear of a physical threat will impact a person's physiological systems. uncertainty, general uncertainty, can have that kind of an impact. If you take a look at the fifth source, it's talking about somebody who is dying, and the person wants to assign property to particular individuals. Normally, in order to assign property, you require acts of transaction. You require kinyan. However, we're told that just the declaration in front of witnesses is sufficient for his gift to be accepted. Why is that? Says source number 5, the Gemara in Bava Basra. It's rabbinically accepted. The rabbi said, you know what? This shouldn't work, but we will accept it anyway. Lest his mind be torn. The same phrase, Shemati Taref Dato Alav. Lest he be upset because he's worried that it won't be accepted. He wants to make sure that people are going to follow his wishes. And so in order to make sure that he has confidence that people will follow his wishes, we accept it. Why? Because we're concerned that his worry is otherwise going to damage his health. So we've seen emotional pain, financial worry, religious worry, general uncertainty, and physiological imbalance. Here's a dramatic case of it in source number 6, and this is an important source that we're going to have to come back to later. The case of a woman who is giving birth, and it's Shabbos, and she is blind. And she's worried that the room is dark. So take a look at the source. They quote you an early source, a Mishnah, which says, if a woman giving birth needs a lamp, she says, there has to be light in the room. Her friend lights it for her. So the Gemara doesn't assume that we're dealing with a blind woman yet. Right now it's just assuming a woman is giving birth. She says, you need a light. You light it. Now that, says the Talmud, is not a chiddush. That's not a novelty. We know that because giving birth is a dangerous time. If she needs a lamp, light the lamp. That's clear. That's obvious, the Gemara says. To which it's saying, no. This is saying even if she's blind, and therefore whether there's a lamp or not is not going to actually impact her at all. So the scene is the blind woman is giving birth. The midwife says, I have sufficient light. I don't need additional light. The blind woman says, I want to make sure there's enough light in the room. Light the lamp. She's not just legally blind. She's fully blind. She can't tell. You could theoretically just pretend, and she wouldn't actually know the difference. And what it says is, light the lamp anyway. I might have prohibited it, says the Talmud, in source number 6, since she does not see. But this teaches that lighting it will settle her mind. She will think that if there is some need, her friend will see it and do it for her. The answer to our question regarding this blind woman is, you need to settle her mind because she is at a vulnerable time right now. She is in danger because of the being in a state of childbirth. And therefore, we need to make sure that there will be no stress which could endanger her further. It's a recognition that this could lead to greater danger. Now, the truth of the matter is, as I'm saying this, I'm thinking that that's not actually the best example of physiological imbalance, because the stress is not the source of the physiological imbalance is not the source of the stress we're talking about. The birth is the source of the physiological imbalance here. But take a look at the next case, which I think is simpler. And that is the Gemara in Bava Basra, which says, Shinoi veses tchilas choli. A change in dietary routine is the start of illness. They're talking there about somebody who is impoverished and goes all week on very minimal food, and then come Shabbos, they have a big Shabbos meal. And it says, you know, that's not necessarily a good thing. Because it can actually trigger illness. Now you have to look in the source to see what type of illness are they talking about. Is it dietary illness just because the body system now has richer food? Or is it just in general, this is a stressor on the system? But in general, we find a recognition that physiological imbalance will also engender stress, and it's recognized within Jewish law. One last case. That's good enough for now. Those are the stressors that I brought here. There are probably more you could identify within traditional sources, but my goal here is to just show you there's an old recognition of what this does to the body, about even the mental affecting the physical, and there's concern for it within halacha, within Jewish law. So now let's move to the impact side of things. Those are the causes of stress. How about the impact? So, you know, we have many doctors in the room who I hope will not contradict what I'm saying, although they're aware of more. I hope you will contradict it if it's wrong. But I'm hopeful that it's right. Based on the literature that I read, I've put together the list of bullet points in number 8. And you can see there just some of the medical impact of stress, depending on the degree of the stress and depending on how long it lasts. But a higher heart rate and blood pressure, in parentheses I put what leads to those things, but the higher heart rate and the blood pressure as the body prepares for this fight or flight response. Metabolization of fat and protein and elevated blood sugar because the body needs to have energy. But that, of course, if someone is, let's say, a diabetic, right, is going to throw things off in terms of the elevated blood sugar. A suppressed immune response. So the immune impact, from what I understand, actually goes in multiple directions. It's not a simple. It's not simple. Meaning, on the one hand, you get suppressed immune responses in order to channel metabolic resources elsewhere. And then on the other hand, you get the release of cytokines, which will trigger flu-like symptoms for the person, and allergic reactions, and inflammation. So you're actually going in both directions. On the one hand, a suppressed immune system, and on the other hand, immune overreaction going on simultaneously. I actually would like doctors to weigh in. Is that an accurate read of what's going on? Sheldon?
Yeah, but it's subclinical. You wouldn't notice.
Correct. Right. Okay. The main point in mentioning the flu-like symptoms, is that you could have somebody who is experiencing stress because of something that has nothing to do with the flu. They have an exam. But this release of the cytokines, if they're agitated enough, could actually lead them to flu-like symptoms because the body has this immune response in a time of stress. A narrowing of mental focus on the neurological front, where the person is just going to be focusing, his brain is going to be focusing its resources on this particular source of stress, as well as a flooding of the neurons with calcium, which can, over time, lead to the shutdown of neurons in the brain. And then the longer and the more chronic the stress, the more dramatic and widespread the effects on the heart, effects on management of inflammation, wound healing, ability to develop long-term memory, and more. Yes? Sorry? Yeah. Really? Okay. Well, I guess that would make sense. Yeah, I guess that would make sense. Okay, thank you. So, from a medical perspective, you're talking about a range of potentially very negative responses. However, I have to stress the flip side of it, literally the flip side of the sheet in number 9, which is that medically stress can be a positive as well. They actually have two different terms, right? There's the term distress and eustress, which I learned. Eustress, E-U-S-T-R-E-S-S, the E-U prefix meaning good, distress being harmful, eustress being stress that is helpful. Among the benefits, I bullet pointed it here in number 9, is that the body's reaction will summon helper hormones. It can help you to focus on a particular problem. Cell growth in the brain's learning centers will be increased in order to deal with the problem. If a person deals with stress well, it can create a sense of resiliency. What is it that causes stress to be helpful? So among what I've seen, and I gave you a couple of links to articles, stress can be positive if it occurs in conditions which aid willpower, meaning that if you are basically healthy, if you have good nutrition, if you're getting enough sleep, you're more likely to be able to handle a stressor well than if you are missing some of those elements. Another factor, how you perceive stress. That goes back to what I had said in the beginning, that the emphasis is not so much on the cause of the stress as the way we respond to it. So if a person perceives it as something that they can handle, then they can do better with it. A third element, which I found fascinating and frankly would have liked to have spent more time on, but there isn't. But I gave you the link for people who want to follow up on it. Generosity to others. I found a couple of papers that referenced the idea that that helping others can actually aid in a person's response to stress. It sounded very, very interesting, so I made sure to include the link there. Really?
Yeah.
Okay. And then the effect of that?
Which is a positive.
Right. Okay.
Positive mental.
Okay, so for those who couldn't hear, the giving to others can result in the release of oxytocin, and that will have positive effects on the person. Okay.
And something else called dopamine, which is related to addiction.
Right. Okay, so go out and perform chesed. That's the lesson of this, is if you're feeling stressed, you know, go look for somebody to help. Okay.
The best way to get sick is to mind your own business.
There you go. So within halacha, we also have a recognition of the impact of stress on different systems. So one is the neurological. If you take a look at source number 11, you find the Gemara in Erevin, which says that if somebody comes in off of the road, if you come from a long journey, you shouldn't say the Amidah. You shouldn't daven Shemona Esrei for 3 days. Now, we don't paskin this way. This is not our practice for two reasons. One reason is because a journey for us is not what a journey was for them. They're talking about riding on a donkey for days in order to get somewhere. Not that, you know, it was an annoyingly long car ride or you were stuck in traffic. That's number one. Number two, frankly, because the standards for prayer have shifted, where they're imagining that the person is going to have a high level of concentration, and if he can't, then better for him not to pray. Whereas today, the sense that halachic authorities tend to bring to this is, if you're going to wait until you have really good concentration, you're going to go a very long time between prayers. So that's another reason why this has shifted. But I bring it to show you the understanding that the stress of travel is going to tax a person's ability to concentrate. It affects the ability of a person to heal. Take a look at source number 12b, please. A passage from Mishlei, from Proverbs. This is a very early source. The spirit of a person will sustain him in illness. If a person is ill, having good spirits will help him, bless you. But who can bear a broken spirit? If the person is upset, in this case it's stress resulting from some level of depression, ruach nechaya in the Hebrew, that's going to make it harder for him to recover from illness. So much so that the Rambam writes, and I brought you in source number 13 from the quote from the Rambam in Nishmas Avram, he says that he's talking about treating a patient. He says one should tell stories which gladden the patient, broadening his spirit, and things that will remove his mind, meaning from the illness, and cause him to laugh. The Rambam emphasizes the role of the physician as a comedian. I don't know what the Rambam's jokes were. You know, I would love to know what the Rambam said to the patient when he wanted to pick up the patient's spirits. But that's what he says. He says you have to be a storyteller. The Rosh, Rabbeinu Asher, in source number 14, points something out. You know that the Torah says that if you injure somebody, you have to then pay for medical care. So the Gemara asks, well, what if your brother-in-law is a doctor, and you can get him to do this cheaply or for free? Can you say to the person you wounded, I'm willing to pay your medical bills, but you have to use this doctor? And the answer the Gemara says is no. And Gemara says you can't say that because you have to have the right doctor, but you have to have somebody who the patient wants as the physician. And source number 14, the Rosh, Rabbeinu Asher, commented saying that the patient has to have nachas ruach, the patient has to have satisfaction from this doctor, the patient has to feel like this is the doctor for me. And that this issue of stress and its impact on a person's ability to heal comes into the discussion about informing a patient of a terminal diagnosis. right? You're probably familiar with this. We, I think, discussed it a few years ago in one of these sessions. There's a history in halacha of saying if a patient has a terminal diagnosis, you're not supposed to tell him, not supposed to let him know. Now, that's come under fire in recent decades. Because, you know, in general, the idea of patient autonomy and respecting the patient's ability to make decisions and against paternalism says, you know, how dare you deprive the patient of knowledge of his condition? Let the patient deal with it. And that's one reason why that's come under fire. The other reason why it's come under fire from a halachic perspective is because you sometimes think that you're fooling the patient. The patient is putting together the pieces anyway, and is going to come to wrong and potentially destructive conclusions. So one argument, for example, is that if you stop certain treatments, the patient is going to come to conclusions which may not even be correct about how much time they have left or what's wrong and so forth. Better to give the patient the information in a way that will be productive and helpful. Or the patient needs to have an opportunity to make decisions about disposition of assets and giving, you know, whatever last messages they want to give. You don't necessarily want them to not have that opportunity. So I'm not saying as a practical statement, don't give a terminal diagnosis, don't tell them what's going on. But the care that we have traditionally in this regard and the bias towards not telling them is evidence of the concern that people who get stressful information are not going to be able to heal as well and to deal with situations as well. Rav Moshe Feinstein noted this in source number 15, dealing with a triage question, where he had mentioned he has a discussion about triage in which you have a patient already in the unit and you don't have a spare bed, and a new patient comes in. The patient who's currently there, you can't really do much for. He's going to live another day or two. The patient is coming in. If you get him treated right now, you could actually heal whatever is wrong and they could live out their natural lifespan. And Rav Moshe discusses what to do in various circumstances, and in a case in which he does accept substitution, he says what you see in number 15. There is a particular case where he accepts substitution, and he says, the substitution may be done only in a way that the dangerously ill patient will not know that the doctors think that they cannot heal him. If this would cause him to know that they can't heal him, if the substitution would betray the facts to him, he would be frightened. This would hasten his death. His mind would be torn, which is always prohibited. You can't do anything which is going to upset him in that way. So Rav Moshe is concerned about the impact on this patient from that level of stress. But it's not only about the impact on the mind, and it's not only about the impact on a patient who is already ill. You see it in cases of general health as well. Take a look at source number 16. Rav Yitzchak Zilberstein notes this source with a fascinating read that actually is from the Radak, Rav David Kimchi. This is a passage in, you can see, the book of Malachim Beis, Kings 2, with the Navi, the prophet Elisha. They're facing enemy forces. It's Elisha and a youth, and they're facing enemy forces. So Elisha prays, and he says, God, please open his eyes, the eyes of this youth, and he will see. And God opened the youth's eyes, and he saw the mountain was filled with horses and fiery chariots surrounding Elisha. So in other words, it's Elisha and the youth. The youth is panicked because he sees the invading forces. Elisha, Davins, he says to God, open this kid's eyes. And he sees fiery chariots protecting them from the enemy. However, if you had the next verse in front of you, you would see that after that, Elisha prays and the enemy is struck with sanvirim. The enemy is blinded. Leading to the question, if you're going to blind the enemy anyway, what do you need this for? What are you doing this for? Why are you doing this for the youth? Said Rav David Kimchi back in either 13th or 14th century, I forget, it's because they didn't want the youth to panic as a result of the fear of the enemy. It would be detrimental to his health. It was meant to keep him from that fear. If you take a look at source number 17, a passage... Yeah.
Were they fiery chariots?
He only envisions it. In other words, they're not defended by them, so I guess not. It's just for him to envision it in order to bolster his confidence. Yeah. If you take a look at source number 17, a passage from the Talmud Yerushalmi, the Torah says, that when you do mitzvahs, when you do what you're supposed to do, Vehisir Hashem Mimcha Kocholi, God will remove all illness from you. I underlined the word all, kol, all illness, because the Gemara says this is what is called Ra'ayon. Ra'ayon, as in modern Hebrew, means thought. The Karban Ha'eda explains, this is a standard commentary to the Yerushalmi, what the Yerushalmi, what the Jerusalem Talmud is saying is, Kol ha'chala'im tzluyim bihir hurim ra'im. All illnesses depend on bad thought. And so what it's saying is, not bad thought like thought of sin, but negative thoughts. That will impact the person's health. And this has practical applications. If you take a look at source number 18, a passage in the Gemara in Yuma, this is the section of the Talmud that talks about violating Shabbos for the sake of someone who is ill. And they bring you the following statement. If you see that a door is closed in front of a tinok, tinok can mean infant, can sometimes mean small child, you should break the door down and take the infant out. One who's energetic is praiseworthy and need not seek permission from a court. And in context, they're not talking about where there's a hazard in the room. That's not what they're saying. Rather, what they're saying is the child is upset and agitated, and because the child is agitated, it could harm his health, and therefore you are allowed to go break down the door. And they even talk about where you break it down, wanting to make it into wood that you'll be able to use for something else. So you have multiple motivations in mind. Nonetheless, you're allowed to knock down the door, and in fact, you're supposed to. You're not supposed to look for permission, you're supposed to do it. One last source on this front. If you take a look at source number 19, the Gemara in Shabbos, as explained by the Meiri, Rabbi Chanina says you're not allowed to sleep alone in a house. The Meiri, writing in France in either late 13th or early 14th century, says that the reason why you're not supposed to sleep in a house alone is because it inspires fear. And he says, you know, if you can deal with it, he says, it's all according to your nature. But if it inspires fear, you're not supposed to put yourself into that kind of a situation. It's harmful to you. So what emerges, I hope, is this, that you have a very old recognition with halachic ramifications of the danger of experiencing stress, whether it's in terms of your concentration or your ability to heal or your general health, although there is recognition that stress can be a positive. We go back now to the eustress side of things. Because, let's be honest, halacha also imposes stress on people and seems to think that it can be a good thing. If you take a look at source number 20, a classic example, this actually draws on a sentence that appeared in the Maftir that was read yesterday from Parashas Para. The Talmud says, how do we know that Torah endures only in one who kills himself for it? And he quotes the biblical passage, this is the Torah when one dies in a tent. Zos ha-Torah adam ki yamus be'ohel. Now, the verse is taken out of context. That's not the point. The point is not the verse. The point is that the Talmud says, if you want to succeed as a student of Torah, you have to deny yourself the physical and just push yourself to an extreme. Example in source number 21, the fellow Ben Dama who wants to go study Greek wisdom. And Rabbi Yishmael says to him, sure, go ahead, find a time that's neither day nor night, because you are obligated to spend all day and all night in pursuit of Torah study. Well, that kind of an approach creates stress, right? It's a constant expectation. At all times, you are going to be reflecting on the Torah. And you know, don't take this lightly, because this is what happens very often when from my experience, young men, I don't know about the analogous experience for women, but certainly for young men who come out of high school and then they go to study in yeshiva for a year, 2 years, whatever it is, post-high school, there are those who don't handle this experience well, because there is an element of stress as you start to feel like this is my opportunity to study, and you stay up until 1, 2, 3 in the morning, whatever it is, and you're getting up the next morning early to start again. It can create a stressful situation, which is being prescribed. Meaning that's something that is created with a sense that, don't worry, this can be a positive. So that's something, yeah, that's one example. Another example is the privation prescribed in source number 22. the passage there in the Talmud says, in whom is learning found? In one who rises early, remains late in the study hall. And Rabba said, in one who blackens his face like a raven for it, meaning in hunger. Deprive yourself in order to succeed in Torah. Or if you want an example that's not a Torah study example, take a look at the next source, source number 23, in which Rabbi Eliezer gives the following advice. He says, repent one a day before your death. And Rabbi Eliezer's students say to him, well, how do you repent one day before your death? Now, I suppose this could bring us back to the discussion about physician-assisted suicide again. And then the person is able to repent one day before his death. But I'm assuming that that's not what Rabbi Eliezer had in mind. So his students ask him, you know, how does a person repent one day before his death? And his answer to them is, you're right, so he should repent every day. Every day, examine your deeds and go through an experience of tshuva, go through an experience of repentance in order to ultimately live your entire life in repentance. But once again, living your whole life in fear of death, this is another potential concern for stress. There are more. I brought you a Gemara in Brachos. I think I've made the point at this stage that halacha, on the one hand, is very cognizant of the effect of fear and emotional strain, and on the other hand, believes that in certain circumstances, it actually could be a positive. So that brings us now to a question. How does halacha deal with, how does Jewish law deal with the negative impacts of stress? So, point number one, and this is something where I brought you a couple of quotes in number 25 and 26. Some of you may remember this from the Shiur on OCD. I brought it there. And that is a statement from Rabbi Yaakov Kanievsky, the stipler, as well as from Rabbi Yaakov Mordechai Grunwald, who is a physician who consulted with the stipler on cases of OCD specifically, regarding a life of stress, where a person has something pushing him and he's dealing with the extreme case of OCD here. But look what he says. He says, such thinking, the thinking of being strained and nervous and anxious, will I perform this mitzvah? Will I perform this mitzvah properly? Such thinking is a strategy of the Yetzer Hara to weigh upon him the yoke of serving God to the point where it will be a heavy burden for him, and to thereby push him to throw off the yoke of Torah. It's trying to make you miserable. The Yetzer Hara, the inclination for evil, is trying to make you miserable so that you will reject Torah. This isn't the way it's supposed to be. We're not meant to live a life of stress. And Rabbi Grunwald here, in source number 6, says that the person who, whenever performing the will of the Creator, his soul and his energies are ensnared in feelings of unpleasantness, terror, stress, and lack of joy because of performing the mitzvah. And just the opposite, this becomes his usual state. Performing a mitzvah out of joy is the unusual state. This is open proof that this is not God's intention. That's not the way it's supposed to be. Stress is considered a negative. So that's a key point to understand going in. We see stress from a halachic perspective as pain and as threat, and therefore it overrides prohibitions, meaning that there are laws which are broken in order to prevent stress. To what extreme will we go? Well, the first example is source number 27. Rabbi Yosef Kara, writing in the Shulchan Aruch, talks about the case in which a patient feels like the end is near, and the patient says, send for my relatives. So the Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law, says, if a patient is, quote, gripped by the world, it means his illness is getting worse. And he says to send, I added in the words in brackets based on the Mishnah Berurah, he says to send a non-Jew for his relatives, this is certainly permitted. So you will be allowed to ask a non-Jew to travel on Shabbos. That is a rabbinic prohibition. I'm not allowed to ask non-Jews to violate Shabbos for me. Right? It's not Shabbos for them. But nonetheless, it's Amir Lakum. I'm not allowed to tell him to do that. He says, no, you send for the relatives. Have a non-Jew be the one. So the analogous case perhaps today would be, he's not necessarily traveling by wagon to get them, but to ask him to call them and leave a message on their machine or whatever it is to signal them that something has happened, that they'll know to come to the hospital. That would be an example of this. Now, this is a relatively low-level violation in the sense that you have biblical prohibitions, you have rabbinic prohibitions, and then below that, you have a rabbinic prohibition of asking a non-Jew to do something for you on Shabbos. And the reason that's lower than your standard rabbinic prohibition is because you didn't actively do anything that's like a breaking of Shabbos. So because it's a very low level, Rabbi Chiel Michal Epstein in the Aruch HaShulchan makes a distinction in source number 28. And he says, that was permitted. Telling the non-Jew to go for the relatives, that he could do. But a Jew may not perform a rabbinic prohibition himself for this. Sending for the relatives is not healing, but only a concern. You're easing the person's mind. He says, that's not sufficient. So writes the Aruch HaShulchan. He says, the only thing you're allowed to do to relieve stress of a patient on Shabbos would be to ask a non-Jew to do something. However, the Vilna Gaon had a different approach. Because the Vilna Gaon, on this passage in the Shulchan Aruch, in the Code of Jewish Law, didn't point to that level, but instead pointed to source number 29. He said, how did the Shulchan Aruch know that you're allowed to send the non-Jew for this? He says, the Shulchan Aruch looked at number 29, in which the Gemara talks about a person who is dying on Shabbos and wants to dispose of his assets. And the Gemara writes there, the Talmud writes there, you're allowed to perform an act of transaction for this person on Shabbos. What that means is, he can cement the deal on Shabbos and it will be binding because we're concerned about stress. Now, what level of violation of halacha is it to engage in a transaction on Shabbos? It's a rabbinic prohibition, right? It's engaging in a purchase on Shabbos, exactly. It's a rabbinic prohibition lest you write things down, right? As well as in Yeshaya, it may also be mentioned. But the basic principle is, this is a rabbinic prohibition. So by using this as the source, by quoting this as the source, the Vilna Gaon is saying, not only is it that you can send the non-Jew, because now he's doing the rabbinic prohibition, but rather, you are allowed yourself to do the rabbinic prohibition. That's the position taken by the Vilna Gaon. So what we see here is, you can violate a derabbanan. But wait a minute, now you have to remember the source I brought you back in the beginning. Go back for a second, please, to source number 6. We said the woman who's giving birth, who doesn't need the light biologically, physiologically there's no need for it, all the people around her are able to take care of her. Nonetheless, because she is anxious that they won't see properly, we're going to light a lamp on her behalf. Is lighting a lamp biblical or rabbinic? That's a biblical prohibition, lighting a lamp on Shabbos. The Chelkas Yaakov, Rabbi Yaakov Breish, says, I don't understand. He says, you're talking about whether you can tell a non-Jew to do the malacha, whether you can violate a rabbinic prohibition. In that Gemara, which is paskin das halacha in Shulchan Aruch, it's brought in the Code of Jewish Law, the rule is you violate even a biblical prohibition. And not only that, we have much precedent for this idea that you violate biblical prohibitions in order to alleviate stress. Here's a great example of it. The Rambam, source number 30. The Torah lists a number of prohibitions against practices that today we would consider superstition. Right? Talking about like omens, fortune telling, charming animals, and the like. So there are different schools of thought as to why those were prohibited and are prohibited. One school of thought is the Rambam school of thought. The Rambam school of thought is the reason why these are prohibited is because they are foolish, there's no substance to them, and they can lead to idolatry. Take a look at what the Rambam writes in number 30. He says, a person is bitten by a scorpion or a snake. One may chant over the bite of a person who has been bitten by a scorpion or a snake, even on Shabbat, to settle his mind and strengthen his heart. Even though this does not help at all, Rambam says, your incantations are doing nothing, and there's a biblical prohibition against using them. But he says, if someone was bitten, you're allowed to use this. Why? He is dangerously ill, so they permitted this to keep his mind from being torn. It's the concern for the effect of anxiety on the patient is allowing you to violate a biblical prohibition. This is just as much a biblical prohibition as lighting a fire on Shabbos. Yes?
Is the concern simply that it's carrying his mind, or is it actually hastening his death?
Well, that's the thing. The reason why I care about tearing his mind is because it'll have a bad effect on him physiologically. That's where this goes. In other words, if you were able to say, this patient will experience stress, but he'll get better, and I have a crystal ball, and I know he's going to survive it just fine, I don't think the Rambam gives you this heder. I don't think he permits it. I think the understanding is, this is actually going to make things worse for him, the stress, and that's why the Rambam sanctions it. That's my understanding. In and of itself, stress is already seen as bad, and we saw the stifler who said you shouldn't have it, and so forth. But that wouldn't warrant violating a biblical prohibition. Yeah?
But that deals with the cholet.
Yes.
What if doing that settles the minds of the rofim, the nurses, and the rest of it, in order to be metapel b'cholet? Is it then still forbidden?
I thought we had permitted it for the sake of the patient. You're asking if, in other words, if the doctor...
Permitted to do it if the intent is the patient.
Right.
If the intent is the healer.
And the healer is now... You're talking about stress concerns? Or you're talking...
Yes.
Right, so I think that becomes just as permitted. I don't think... I would not make a distinction.
But the healer isn't Cholesh Yesh Bo Sakana.
Right, but I think what we're looking at here is that the stress is the obstacle to the patient getting better. And whether that's stress on part of the healer or stress on the part of the patient, fundamentally, this is an obstacle in the way. To put it differently, let's say it was Shabbos and the healer, whoever it was far away, right? But this is the person to the patient needs to get better. We would send a car.
Yeah, that's already answered.
But it's the same concept. In other words, if this is what is obstructing, if this is what is keeping him from healing, then that's what we need to alleviate. Yes?
Question about this case number 30, if they apply more generally. So... although this may keep doing this chanting may keep his mind from being torn, it may also perhaps some false hope. And you realize that this thinks that there's really false hope.
Right. So the Rambam seems to have no problem with placebos. With the idea that we're going to give him something and he thinks that we're actually, you know, helping him and we're not. Yeah, I believe that if you're saving the patient's life, then we're good with that. You may have to explain to him later on that, you know, we don't believe in these things. But the Rambam seems to have no problem with that. And even though we've now reinforced it for him, meaning I can see the patient coming away from this and saying, they say that the chants don't work, but look, I'm better. I can see you potentially reinforcing him in this belief. Nonetheless, he seems to have no problem with it. We're going to see another case here. Take a look at the Rashba in source number 31, dealing with amulets. Amulets are mentioned Talmudically and discussed Talmudically, and they discuss the idea of a proven amulet. A proven amulet is an amulet which worked 3 times in a row for this particular illness. So, granted that I can't possibly explain why an amulet would work, if you see it works 3 times in a row for this illness, that's the equivalent of FDA testing. Right, so it wasn't double blind. No. They also had issues with numbers, but basically N equals 1. Sorry, yeah? Rambam is very against amulets, just like he was against incantations. He felt they were all false and didn't work. But take a look at 31. Look at what the Rashba says. The Rashba says, we write any amulet, even on Shabbos, for a dangerously ill patient or a woman giving birth where they request it, to settle their mind, even though we don't know whether or not it is an expert amulet. If they say, write this amulet for me, the answer is, you bet. The Meiri brings this as well. I didn't bring it on the sheet because I felt like it was, you know, just bringing too many sources here. But the Meiri mentions it as well in the passage in the Gemara in Yuma where they talk about, there's a sage by the name of Rabbi Masya ben Harash, who talks about feeding a patient dog liver because that was believed to be a cure for something that may be rabies or may not be rabies. Leave aside any physiological discussions about why this would or would not work, but he permits it. And again, the many sages, including the Meiri, I mean, I think including the Rambam, say this doesn't work. So why are you permitting him to eat treif? And the answer, once again, is he thinks it works, and therefore it will help to dispel the stress, and it will calm him down. That's the idea that they express. Note, they're not saying it will have a healing effect in and of itself. What they're saying is it will dispel the stress that he is feeling. So now I have a problem. Because 5-7 minutes ago, I told you that the patient is ill, and he says, call my relatives, you're only allowed to do you know, telling the non-Jew to go summon the relatives. And the Aruch HaShulchan said, you wouldn't even be allowed to violate a rabbinic prohibition yourself. And the Vilna Gaon gave me source to say, well, I could violate a rabbinic prohibition myself from the case of the Kinyan, the transaction on Shabbos. But here we have a whole long list of biblical prohibitions we're willing to violate. Didn't the Aruch HaShulchan know that? Didn't the Vilna Gaon know that? So I think the only real answer you can give is the answer given by Rabbi Dr. Avram Sofer Abraham in source number 32. There's a similar idea in the Tzitz Eliezer in Chelek Ches, Tesvav, Siv Tes. And that he writes the following. One must say that the sages distinguish between two kinds of settling the mind. In one, the dangerously ill patient's situation would become worse, such that his mind would be torn should they not fulfill his request. And then he would enter still greater danger. So one may violate Shabbos, even biblical prohibitions, to prevent this. The second is where it would cause his spirits to fall and he'd be upset, but he would not be in any danger if they would not do as he asked. Here one may only violate rabbinic prohibitions of Shabbos. He says, you have to know what you're dealing with. Are you dealing with a case that could endanger his life? Then we view stress just like any other problem that he is facing, and we will violate a d'oraisa in order to eliminate stress. For you wonder why I spent half an hour building up how the Gemara recognizes sources of stress and phenomena of stress and impact of stress. It's in order to get to this point, to realize that they view it as a risk just like anything else. And therefore, the position of halacha is, if you think it's really endangering his life, violate biblical prohibitions in order to mitigate it. If, on the other hand, you feel like it's not that big a deal, it's a factor that's making him ill, and it should be avoided, so then you violate a rabbinic prohibition in order to. Practical case where this comes up, person has, you know, God forbid, something happened to them on Friday night, they get taken in the ambulance. Their spouse wants to go too, isn't able to get into the ambulance for whatever reason. Can the spouse go by car? Right? Is the spouse allowed to go to the hospital by car in order to be with them? So the Nishmas Avram, in dealing with this question, says, if you have no other way to get there, meaning you don't have the option of a non-Jew and you couldn't get into the ambulance or whatever else, then he says, yes, you go. He also adds to that, because you may be able to help in terms of providing medical information. It isn't only, you know, this isn't the only factor that needs to be considered. But this comes up in a range of halachic cases. I'm just going to list you the cases without going through them in the interests of time. But this calculation comes up in the discussion of a husband holding his wife's hand in childbirth. If she is a nida, if she is bleeding, there's some question as to is she allowed to hold is he allowed to hold her hand? That comes up. This issue of stress comes up in that discussion. The issue of an avel, you have a mourner who has a relative who wasn't informed. In other words, we mentioned earlier, if someone is ill, if someone is very infirm, we're not going to tell them of the passing of a relative. So imagine the following situation. A man's wife, Rahmanul Itzlan, a man's wife passes away. The man himself is too ill for us to inform him. But he has a son, and the son is sitting Shiva. The son knows if my father doesn't see me visit him in the hospital for a couple of days, he's going to know something is wrong. Not only does the son leave the Shiva house to go visit him, but the son should change his clothing and do whatever he has to do to make sure it will not be obvious to the father that he is in Avelus, that he's in Shiva, in order to make sure to take care of the father's health. Rav Moshe Feinstein says that the reason why a person who started taking medicine on Wednesday and needs to take a course of the medicine for several days is allowed to continue to take it on Shabbos is because if you don't let him take it on Shabbos, he's going to be agitated and upset and it could lead to a nervous breakdown. That's actually what Rav Moshe says. It comes up in all sorts of halachic discussions. It comes up in discussions about not fasting on fast days if it could cause a person stress. There's a case discussed by the Ramban back in the 13th century of a person who had taken a vow not to play cards. And then he was in some condition where he was very stressed, and that would be his way of calming himself down. And he allows you to nullify the vow on the basis of he needs this in order to be able to calm down. It comes up in all sorts of remarkable situations, and we could have spent the entire time just on some of these cases. We emphasize in halacha the importance of dealing with stress and fighting the harmful effects of stress. So that you will find, I'm going to skip this, so that you will find in the interest of getting to the next point. Sorry. You can see on your sheet, source number 33, we talk about having public prayer on behalf of somebody on Shabbos. When you're dealing with somebody who is just experiencing anxiety, that itself is sufficient. But what I wanted to make sure to get to, because I was asked about this before the shiur, is the issue of mitzvah obligations. Can someone be exempt from a halachic obligation because of stress? And the answer is, you bet. We need to talk about a few different categories. Number one, where stress makes the mitzvah difficult to practice. We already saw the case of the person who came from a journey and therefore he can't really daven properly, and saying we don't want him davening. But I'll give you a better case. The case of a Tanis Chalom, a person who has a scary dream on Friday night. The Gemara mentions that if a person has a frightening dream, he should fast. Now, there's a lot of discussion in the Gemara about whether dreams mean anything or not. And the majority view in the Gemara, according to most readings of the Gemara, is that no, we generally believe dreams are a function of what you think about during the day. However, nonetheless, the person is told to fast, and even if you take a look at source number 34, even on Shabbos, the person should fast. And I had this happen when I was a rabbinic intern in a shul in New Jersey. The shul had a Sephardic minyan, and there was a fellow at the minyan who came over to me before davening Shabbos morning. He said he had a terrible, terrible dream, and he wanted to fast, and he wanted to know if he'd be allowed to fast on Shabbos. Now, I was only the intern, so therefore I was able to kick it upstairs. But the answer is yes. The answer is yes. And the Gemara asks, well, what do you do? How do you make up for the fact that you missed your Shabbos meals? There's a mitzvah of oneg Shabbos. You're supposed to enjoy Shabbos. And the answer is, so let him fast on Sunday to make up for having fasted on Shabbos. That'll show him. But the idea there is a recognition of the stress that he is feeling and that this will be his enjoyment of Shabbos. If you force him to eat, he's not going to enjoy it. He's going to be miserable. He will be happier feeling like he did something to atone for whatever it is that's facing him, and that will be an antidote for the stress created by the dream. But stronger than this, what about when a mitzvah itself creates stress? Mitzvahs can create stress. Example I mentioned before, right? The case of the groom who is stressed because he wants to fulfill pruravu, he wants to be with his wife, that would be one case. But I give you another example here in source number 35, the bottom of one side, the top of the next side, dealing with the issue of vidui. A person who is dying is supposed to recite vidui, is supposed to admit what his sins are, he's supposed to admit what he has done wrong. This always leads to a problem of, at what point do you advise somebody that they should say vidui? I had a horrific situation. This was terrible. The RCA, the Rabbinical Council of America, publishes a book, a guide for rabbis. It's called Hamadrich, the Guide. And it has in it various texts that are important for various occasions, including a text for vidui. So I, in my first shul, am visiting somebody who is in this situation where it really is time for them to say vidui, but they were still composed enough that they could read, and they had a yeshiva education, they could read the Hebrew without a problem. So I wanted to give him the text to read. And, there's a preamble you're supposed to say, which the Gemara says. You're supposed to say to the person, many people have said this, and they have lived, and they've gone on to be fine. This doesn't mean we're giving up on you. But the thing at the top of it said, the dying patient, or something like that at the top of the page. As I'm about to hand him the book, I see it at the top of the page. I quickly grab it back, tear off the top of the page, and then gave it to him. You have to be careful about things like that. But the question is, a person who is handed this, even without something written on the top of the page, knows exactly what's going on. And he understands that you're telling him many of people have done this and lived. And he also understands that if you really believed he was going to live, you wouldn't be giving him this to say. So take a look at Rav Shabbos Ha'ar Cohen in source number 35. He says, you only give this to the person specifically where he is dying. If he is not dying, we do not say confess, so that his heart will not be broken. Even though we say many people walk about the market after confessing, when we tell someone, confess, for those who are put to death, confess, he knows he's in very great danger. There's no way around the fact that this is, you know, this is a bad message. Frankly, even the rabbi walking into the room for some patients is frightening. They think, oh, that's it. So sometimes you have a case in which the mitzvah itself can create stress, and that will change the way that we're going to practice it. Another example, there was a law called Hefsed Meruba. Hefsed Meruba means?
Great loss,
excessive loss, great loss. And the rule is that in certain circumstances involving a great financial loss, certain laws can be overridden in order to prevent that great loss from happening. Well, take a look at source number 36, where Rav Shavsei HaKohen, also known as the Shach, gives us a guide to such cases. He says, a time of strain, when we talk about Sha'as HaDchak, a time of strain, that is specifically the following, a case of great loss or lesser loss for a pauper regarding a significant item, if it's significant to him, or a wealthy person, for the sake of the honor of Shabbos and Yom Tov, that would be considered a case of great need, or the honor of guests. You invited guests, and now, if I rely on the mainstream view, my food is treif. Can I rely on the minority view? Or will I have to be embarrassed in front of my guests? The answer, once again, here is you can rely on the minority view. That's what he's telling you, because of concern for embarrassment in front of the guests. There are many more such cases. I brought you source number 37, the Shmir Shabbos Kehilchas, that talks about using an inhaler on Shabbos. There's a rabbinic prohibition against use of medicine other than in cases, you know, of great need on Shabbos. So he mentions that where dignity is involved, the person has an inhaler, he wants to use it on Shabbos because he has a cold and his nose is running, there's room for greater leniency because of the embarrassment that the person is going to experience. Number 38, Rabbi Yisrael Gans, writing about OCD and dealing with OCD, he says, in cases that come before you regarding sufferers of religious compulsions, I think it is important to recall that which the Gedolei Yisrael, such as the Stipler and Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach and others, have opined on this matter, that in every case of doubt in the halacha, one is to decide on the lenient side of the question. Likewise, even if it is unclear whether there is a doubt, one is also to be lenient. So this comes up, again, in case after case, but the point is that where the halacha itself, where the mitzvah itself is the cause of stress, it may well be overridden halachically. In all cases, and I really should have stressed this more, emphasized this more at the beginning, in all cases you have to ask your posik, you have to ask a halachic authority. Don't make assumptions that Totino just sat here for an hour telling you that that stress overrides everything. These cases have to be dealt with properly in a halachic framework. But I'm trying to show you the emphasis on recognizing it as a health risk. I have two other sections to get to very quickly, so I'm going to take questions at the end. The one that I wanted to make sure to get to is the question of whether halacha views stress as ones. Is it something that you can't surmount, and therefore all full speed ahead, permit what you need to permit? Or do we say to a person, tough it out? How do we approach this? So in certain circumstances, we do seem to say it's ones. It's something that you can't deal with. So for example, the case of the person who came back from a long trip, we don't say to him, force yourself to focus on davening. We say to him, skip it. We're not saying you have to force yourself. In extreme case, I brought you in source number 39 from the Shulchan Aruch. If a person takes his life, and he was compelled, like King Saul, we withhold nothing. We withhold no honors from him. The person who committed suicide under strain. And when it says compelled, Shaul HaMelech was not compelled by somebody killing him. That wasn't the case of Shaul. It was the fear of the enemy capturing him and what would happen and so forth. And this isn't understood to mean that if a person committed suicide because of strain, we don't say, well, he should have toughed it out. We recognize the impact that it had. The Netziv of Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin wrote the same thing in a commentary to Shmos Perek Dalet Pasuk Gimel Chapter 4 Sentence 3. He dealt with it. He dealt with it as well. He says fear is sometimes considered ones. It's considered something insurmountable. However, because there's always the however, we do have circumstances where people are told to get over it. So I gave you an example in source number 40. Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach has a really good question. You're telling me that in cases of stress and fear and anxiety, we're going to override rabbinic law and potentially even biblical law. Well, what about the following circumstance? A person's house is burning down. There's a fire burning down his house on Shabbos. There's no issue of danger to anybody else, meaning what we're talking about is a circumstance in which the fire cannot spread. It's the hypothetical case. The way our houses are built, certainly in Thornhill, you know, things spread very quickly. But imagine a hypothetical case. There's no one inside. There is no way it can spread. He's not allowed to put it out on Shabbos. That's the rule. He's going to have to watch his property be destroyed. He can take it. There are certain things he can take out. That's his own discussion. But basically, he's going to have to watch his house burn down. Rav Shlomo Zalman says, imagine the stress. Right? Why is it that this person is expected to put up with just watching his stuff go up in flames? What, you know, putting out the fire is a rabbinic prohibition. It's not a biblical prohibition. There's a biblical prohibition against extinguishing a flame because you want to use the fuel for something. But in this case, it would only be rabbinic. So look at what he says in source number 40. Since the fire itself is not dangerous, but he only puts it into his heart and his pain, note the phrase, he puts it into his heart. Notes in Elibo, he agitates himself. And he does not strengthen himself with faith in God. This is considered like a person who actively takes his own life. So here, Shlomo Zalman says, you're doing it to yourself. Now, frankly, it's not clear. First of all, please ask your halachic authority regarding what to do in the event of a fire. And ask in advance. Don't wait. That's Rabbi Eliezer's advice. One day before.
It's a burning question.
But I don't have a clear sense from this and from everything I've read of where we say to somebody, tough it out, and where we say we need to violate on your behalf. I don't think it is clear cut. I don't think it is a clear line. I think that it really is very subjective and dependent on the individual and dependent on the case. Is this a person who's getting himself upset, or is this somebody who is you know, pushed into a situation? It's not at all clear to me. And so this requires further research. Last point, coping mechanisms. So within Judaism itself, I brought you three verses. One verse is source number 41. De'agav b'lev ish yashchena. V'davar tov yisamchena. The Gemara in Yuma gives us two explanations of this verse. The first explanation is more pshat, is more the translation of the words. When worry is in a person's heart, he should remove it. Remove the worry. That would be a more literal read. However, the second explanation in the Talmud is, when worry is in a person's heart, he should speak of it. Find somebody to talk to. And this is a colloquialism that's used to say, Dagav Levish Yishchana is the way it ends up being read, you should speak of it to others. Look for social support. That's number one. Number two, source number 42, from Tehillim, a popular phrase, Hashlech al Hashem Yehavcha v'hu yechalkelecha. Throw your burden upon God, and God will support you. Faith to reduce your fear of stress will hopefully reduce its impact. And then last, making time for joy. V'samachta b'chagecha. A person has to make sure to have times that are times for celebration. It's kind of ironic because usually holidays induce stress for people. This is part of that discussion about positives bringing stress. Pesach is coming. Nonetheless, remembering to celebrate and remembering to take those times of joy, and note, celebrating not just yourself, but with others. That chesed element, the kindness of it, where you bring in the people at your gates to celebrate with you. That's another antidote for stress. So to give a 1 second summary of where we've been for the last hour and 12 minutes. We started out with sources of stress and said they could be negative or positive, something that's recognized medically, but also that the Talmud itself recognizes, whether in terms of emotional pain, financial worry, physical threats, uncertainty, physiological, religious tension. We then moved from that to talk about the impact of stress medically as well as halachically, and showed that within Jewish sources we find the recognition that stress can be harmful, damaging healing, neurologically effective, damaging one's general health. Although we also noted that there are times when stress is prescribed, such as in pursuit of Torah study. In particular, we find the idea of stress as a potential good. We then asked how halacha deals with the negative impacts of stress. We emphasized that we're not supposed to be miserable with stress, that stress can take away from a person's religious observance. We said that we see stress as pain and even a threat, so you could override certain prohibitions, potentially even biblical prohibitions, depending on the case at hand, as explained by Rabbi Dr. Avram Sofer Abraham. Depends on the degree of danger from the stress, but even violation of a biblical prohibition could be accepted. And we talked about exempting a person from mitzvah obligations where the mitzvah itself is causing stress for the person. We said that stress is often seen as ones, something uncontrollable, but sometimes we are told, get over it. And that requires some analysis in terms of when one is able to say, when one is expected to get over it. And then finally, we had those few verses at the end, which provide us with some degree of coping mechanisms found within Tanakh itself, looking for social support, having faith, and making time for celebration as well as generosity for others. There is much more to be said. I hope this was something of a helpful overview. And tonight, in this room, God willing, at 8:15, there is a Haggadah.